Welcome to the Development Policy Centre. In this podcast, you'll hear Richard Boncher of DFET present the key findings from a report that makes the case for adopting a problem-driven approach to public financial management reform in Pacific Island countries. This is followed by a panel of experts from DFET, the World Bank and the NOSET Institute for Global Health discussing the implications of the report's findings. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks a lot for coming to this workshop here today on public financial management in Pacific Island countries and on really on problem solving around this theme. I'm Stephen Howes, and I direct the Development Policy Centre, and we're hosting the workshop today, but it's really Bob Warner whose idea it was, so thank you, Bob, and a range of others you'll hear from. But also Camilla Burcott. Camilla's put in a lot of work to make this workshop happen. So in fact, it's in two parts. This is the public part, and then we can have a secret discussion. But I'm sure if anyone's interested, if you're inspired by this public forum, if you want to learn more, I'm sure you'd be welcome. Right, Bob?
Yeah.
So if you want to stay on, it's more about, the second part is more about future research, how we can take this further. So if you're interested in that, just stay around for a cup of coffee. Well, everyone stay around for coffee and then ask us where about the next workshop. You're very welcome to come along. Before we start, let's acknowledge the traditional owners, the first Australians and the owners of the land on which we're meeting, and let us pay our respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. So we've got an hour and a half for this session, and we've got quite a lot to get through. So I'm going to ask all the speakers to stick to their time limits. The report that we're focusing on today, and I guess we're launching, is that right, in some way? Okay, so we're launching the report, is called Strengthening Public Financial Management Reform in Pacific Island Countries, the same as the title of this, and it's a joint effort from, I think, DFAT, World Bank, NZAID,
yep,
and ODI.
That's correct.
All right, so many cooks, but I think the chief cook is Richard Bontier.
It's Tobias.
It's Tobias, okay. So Tobias is going to comment on the quality of your presentation of the report, Richard. But as I understand, Richard, who's one of the authors, is going to be summarising the report for us. And so we've given you 20 minutes, a generous allotment, 20 minutes. And then after that, we're going to have a panel of discussants, including Tobias, who is joining us from Washington, I assume.
Afghanistan.
Right. Okay, this is a tough introduction. From Kabul. Where he's now working with the World Bank, and then we're going to hear from Julian Barbara. Julian is now with SSGM. I'm sure you all know him well. He's done a lot of work on Solomon Islands and now with CDI. Susan Ivetts with the World Bank, working on health. And I guess that a big part of this is about the link between public financial management and service delivery. Susan will be addressing that. And then Peter Anir from the NOSL Institute. Thanks very much for coming, Peter. And I do have apologies, I'll mention now, from Barbara McPaik, also the NOSL Institute, and Joel Negan from Sydney, who are unable to make it. So we should get through all of that by 1:40, and then we'll still have ample time for discussion and a good Q&A session. All right, so without further ado, I'll hand over to Richard. Please welcome Richard Bontier.
Thank you for the opportunity of being here today, and it's great to see the level of interest in your heart here to talk about such an interesting subject around PFM. I'm serious. So first of all, I just want to express appreciation for the ANU for putting on the event. This is a great opportunity. I also express appreciation to Tobias, you can't see now, for the great work we did in the collaborative effort in pulling this together, of which Tobias was the lead author. I think it's a lack of research into PFM and broader issues in the Pacific. So this is one of the few review pieces looking at the progress of reform in the Pacific. So being part of that to me has been a good opportunity. I'm not sure how many of you have read the report. Do I have a show of hands? You don't have to own up to it. So the genesis is somewhat twofold. The first is a piece that was done by Tobias again back in 2012, looking at capacity shortfalls as a binding constraint, specifically looking at the Pacific context. And that looked at the relationship between smaller countries and PIFA scores and the fact that it's probably unrealistic to expect high PIFA scores and aiming for that A across the board in that type of capacity constrained context. But also predates that back to a piece done by PIFTAC, the Pacific Financial Technical Assistance Centre, where they produced a roadmap for the Foreign Economic Ministers meeting in 2009, where they set out a plan for the approach to PFM roadmaps in the Pacific. So we were looking at those two pieces and trying to track to, well, how have things evolved over those 5 years? Was the original plan set out and presented to FEM the right approach, and have there been significant improvements in delivery of PFM reforms in the Pacific context? So there's three reports that have come out over that that duration. The first, as I've already mentioned, was in 2012, looking at the impact of capacity on PIFA scores. The second was a 2013 piece, which provided a framework to develop PFM roadmaps with a problem-based approach. That was more of a theoretical framework, and we thought that was useful to set out a view to using problem-based approaches to develop PFM roadmaps. One of the points made by people in presenting that report was that it lacked the practical foundations. So the third piece that we're talking about today, the 2016 report, looks at how PFM roadmaps have had an impact and looking at two case study countries to look at the that experience. And those two case studies were Tonga and Kiribati. The 2013 report made a number of conclusions on the context of PFM reforms, particularly political economy. It also made the point that reforms should be fit for purpose rather than just implementing blueprint PFM systems. And examples of that would be medium-term budgeting and the like. And the need to look beyond capacity building to looking at supplementation and substitution options rather than just doing capacity building, particularly in contexts where there's a lack of staff available. An extreme example, perhaps looking at Nauru, where there's very few government officials and there's a need to look at options for ongoing capacity substitution, not just through donors, but also looking at the government outsourcing some of those core functions. And the need to look at best practice or good practice, and I differentiate between good and best practice because the key point coming out of those reports is that it's not necessarily best practice that's most applicable, but looking at what is actually appropriate to the context, recognising capacity constraints and the objectives. An example of that, looking at better practice, is the, I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, but the PIFA self-guided or self-assessment process, as it's called, which is implemented by PIFTAC, and that was very much in response to criticisms of consultants coming in and doing an assessment and giving the report to governments as a basis for roadmaps. Essentially, there's very little interaction other than asking lots of questions. The self-assessment process is intended to be more informal, more engaging, and giving government ownership and understanding as a precursor to development of the PIFA roadmaps, PFM roadmaps. Oops. Did I press
the wrong button?
Try that one again.
There.
Oops, wrong way. So here are some good practice lessons that came out of the 2013 report. The first is to, I mean, it's an obvious one, but from our discussions was a key deficiency in terms of focusing on PFM reforms as a technical objective. So it highlights the importance of recognising political context. On this point, it's also important to recognise both the formal and informal. So it's not just about the, first of all, recognition. Secondly, having the political engagement. And thirdly, to recognise who you're engaging with, both in formal and informal capacity. So what we were identifying is the lack of even recognition, the political context in terms of looking at reform opportunities. So some of one of the objectives of the PFM roadmaps is to actually elevate it up to cabinet level so there's formal high-level recognition of the reforms rather than being driven at a technical level. Allocating sufficient time and resources, government leadership, extensive consultation. On consultation, that's actually another really interesting one. It's from my observations is that having extensive consultation is really useful, but doing it in the absence of clear priorities can be quite dangerous at the same time. If I look at the Tonga roadmap, for example, it's quite lengthy, almost to the point of becoming a laundry list of reform opportunities, which isn't linked to capacity to implement the reforms. So having that consultation without it being very clear about what the objectives are, but rather leading it through a technical-led reform discussion, can actually be quite counterproductive. That said, the consultation in and of itself is an important feature. A medium-term focus and, of course, adequate flexibility to recognise changes in circumstances. And most importantly, from my perspective, again, looking at the Tonga experience, is matching it to available capacity and being carefully prioritised. So what does this research look at? It builds on the 2013 report, as I mentioned, by looking at a case study approach. So looking at what has been the practical experience and how does it relate to the 2009 PFTAC plan for PFM reform in the Pacific, and how does the experience relate to the 2000 original report, looking at how things have developed. One of the key questions we're also looking at is 5 years on from the PFTAC roadmap, what has been the experience? Has it been effective? And what lessons can we learn? So what did we find? Well, the first conclusion was that, in a sense, despite the divergences in the quality of PFM systems, both were broadly, and I use the word carefully, functional. So it's really interesting to think of what do we mean by functional in the Pacific context. And what we don't mean is that it's best practice. What we're looking at, and this is drawn from the Jack Diamond approach in sequencing of PFM reforms, and there's a range of different ways of viewing it. What are the building blocks and the objectives of PFM reform over time? So the lower blue section talks about, what are the essential or core ingredients to a PFM system? And the way he describes it is a focus on financial compliance and fiscal control, which is essentially the minimal requirements for a credible PFM system. Moving beyond that is looking at macro fiscal stability and sustainability, and lastly looking at efficiency and sustainability and effectiveness. Now this is really important when you look at what this means from a service delivery perspective. Whilst we'd say that both Tonga and Kiribati were sort of in the red zone in a positive way, neither had really gone very far into looking at effectiveness and efficiency in delivery of services, and I'll come back to that point down the track. So the report draws on significant literature on prioritisation of PFM reforms and looking at applying that through problem-based approaches. One of the interesting things coming out of both reports is that for 2013 and 2016 is not to have an excessive reliance on PFA scores. So, of course, I'll put up a bunch of PFA scores because that's useful as a reference. And just to reinforce the points I've been making, looking at Kiribati, you see a clustering around the D and D plus scores, which indicates there's particularly around budget execution that there are fundamental problems with the PFM system when you compare it to an ideal system. Tonga, on the other hand, compares relatively well. So in a way, that shows that the differences between the two. It also highlights that the danger of comparing two countries across PIFA scores, because they are very different. And thirdly, highlights that looking at this in isolation from the problems and symptoms you're seeing in terms of a development perspective doesn't really give you an indication of how the problems relate to what the results or impacts of the poor PFM performance are. Just to also touch on in Kiribati, just to reinforce the points about the six score, particularly around budget execution, some of these drive sweeped service delivery, and examples of that are, and this is why context is very important, geography. A big driver of the low score is around the remoteness of the outer islands. And using the TELMO, which is the telegraphic money order system, that leads to significant delays. That was a key driver of the weak scores. Weak line ministry expenditure management, MOF delays in payment processing, payrolls records not updated, compliance with processes, weak links with planning and processes. All of these things have direct impacts on service delivery. So what are some of the broader findings? Firstly, PFM reforms did not follow a formal plan, PFM reform plan, in either Kiribati or Tonga, which is quite interesting given that both countries had formal PFM reform plans. In the case of Tonga, it wasn't authorised, it wasn't signed up by Cabinet, but still one existed and there was extensive consultation in relation to it. What were the reasons for this? Well, in Kiribati, the PFM reform plan had a large amount of reforms and was not seen as useful. And it was ultimately replaced informally by a PIFTAC review, which was conducted, that identified FMIS and associated business processes as the opportunities for and prioritised as the reform opportunities. In Kiribati, there was a number of really big drivers of problems around macroeconomic challenges. But the success of reforms around this were not very clear, including reforms to debt management and the RERF, which was the Revenue Equalisation and Reserve Fund, and some reforms to SOE sector around privatisation of the telecommunications industry. In Tonga, improvements in procurement are likely to have led to some improvement in value for money and public expenditure, while audit reforms supported increased confidence amongst donor partners, opening the door for increased budget support, which has actually been a very big interesting one. Generally, people saw procurement as more a technical reform process, but it's actually led to a strong focus on service delivery outcomes, looking at procurement opportunities. Budgets in both countries provide a reasonably reliable plan on how much is spent in aggregate and by which ministry, although plans become much less reliable at below the ministry level. Corruption and fraud are limited in both countries, but there are important concerns regarding inefficiencies and, again, the tie to service delivery. The PIFTAC report recommendations. Based on international experience, the document concluded that PFM reforms in Pacific countries should, amongst other things, reflect country priorities, take account of country constraints, including capacity constraints, and have strong country ownership and take political dimensions into account. So one of the things we concluded is that the report was that these original recommendations to report still largely hold. The sustained presence of international advisors did lead to important improvements within existing policy contexts. For example, in Kiribati, a tax administration reorganisation of the Economic and Planning Office and integration of budget and planning and improved systems for reconciliation. In Tonga, line assistance in tax and customs administration delivered important gains. Sorry. I'll go forward now. Oops, that's it. So overall, we did find a good alignment between priorities with most either strong or some link, but a push for the major reforms rather than focus on systems compliance. And this is more in relation to the point I made earlier about blueprint type of approaches. What we see is that, particularly in Melanesian countries, is a basic lack of compliance with existing procedures rather than the need for more elaborate type of reform processes. So there's a general attraction, particularly by development partners, to have demonstrable reforms rather than, if you look at compliance measures, it's very difficult to actually assess the progress in compliance activities, even though, again, from a service delivery perspective and transparency and accountability, sometimes it can have the greatest impact. 5 minutes. Sorry?
5 minutes.
Okay. Examples of the weak or system-wide or package reforms. In Tonga, there was a perception that public debt was a problem, leading to this led to technically advanced reform efforts to build debt management institutions. This is despite a relatively simple debt portfolio and very limited debt management capacity. There was only two officers there. Staff in debt management office were viewed their role as principally administrative rather than actually the more technical aspects of managing a portfolio of borrowing and borrowing options. The actual problem was fundamentally political. Politicians were contracting loans without proper process, yet we put in place an elaborate debt management process and system. Whilst great to have it in place now, it didn't match the problem at the time and diverted resources. In Kiribati, SOE reforms implemented an entire new governance model based on OECD experience. Again, it looks very nice, but it didn't match the capacity constraints in Kiribati. Whilst it's on the way to fixing the problems, arguably it's led to a very strong diversion of resources and lengthened the time required to fix the actual problems. An interesting but contentious one in some circles is around implementation of medium-term budgeting. And I differentiate medium-term budgeting and medium-term expenditure frameworks from medium-term fiscal frameworks, which is a very high-level process. So in both countries, there was an attempt to do a very detailed medium-term budget and expenditure exercise. Whilst they're useful, potentially, if the information is not used for better decision-making, it's a lot of effort that doesn't achieve very much, particularly in contexts where it's questionable the extent to which even the single-year budget framework is leading to effective results. So it's, again, a question of what gains do you get for the capacity investment you make compared to the opportunity cost. In Kiribati, what were the key development constraints that were identified? Weak service delivery, and that, as I've already mentioned, it's things such as geography, payments processing, fiscal deficits, and in Tonga, which is different types of problems. So it was around service delivery, poor alignment with resourcing against priorities, weak revenue, poor procurement, and also public accountability and public access to information, and also the operation of the Public Accounts Committee. We also found the capacity constraints often undermine implementation across both countries. It's not a question of not too many reforms, but the complexity of the reforms that were put in place. Why the capacity constraints? There's a associated with PFM reforms, there's two reasons are twofold. Instances of larger number of reforms being pursued simultaneously, and also reforms in one area sometimes divert capacity away from other equally or possibly more important areas. I've already mentioned medium-term budgeting. But also in Tonga, the compliance requirements around corporate planning, in isolation, that's a great idea, but what we haven't seen is the results from the corporate planning leading to a significant improvement in management by the loan ministries. Then we look at the relationship to the political context and support of the reforms. Again, we find there was a reasonably good degree of compliance with that, particularly around the RERF in Kiribati and procurement in Tonga. Again, the one in Pikumin in Tonga was an interesting one because whilst there was high-level political support, there's been a lot of opposition in terms of implementation of procurement reform by the line ministries. So it's not clear-cut whether or not political support, what that represents. It's quite can be quite divisive. And again, the recognition that political economy reforms is important and the impacts on vested interests, particularly if you're talking about rent-seeking behaviour and corruption opportunities which are taken away by improving transparency and accountability. In some cases, reforms were simply pursued without high-level political buy-in and without policymakers understanding the implications. Now, an example of that was the value-added tax in Kiribati. I think whilst it's nice to have it in place, the lack of understanding of the high-level political context did lead to a winding back of some of the an increase in the level of exemptions from the VAT, which undermines its effectiveness. So the key recommendations, or five recommendations coming out of the report. Firstly, there needs to be adequate resourcing for roadmap development, and this is a consistent theme throughout all the reports. A point we made in recently going with the review of the PIFA process was trying to have the PIFA summary reflect the development priority context, and we didn't get very far with that, but still this is something we're working with PIFTAC on. Plan for fixed resource constraint. And that ties back to a point I made earlier on about being very clear about what the development priorities are and the problems and the capacity constraints as a basis for the engagement and consultation. I think there's been quite a few instances where that has taken place without recognition of the constraints, and ultimately trying to wind back a laundry list of reform opportunities is very difficult because it undermines the consultation that has taken place. Second recommendation was setting up working groups to support ongoing coordination. That's essentially reflects a replication of what's already taking place in the joint policy budget support processes. So maybe it's better integration with that process, but also recognition of the commonality. The third recommendation is around PFM technical assistance models, modifying those to provide greater emphasis on outcomes rather than policy, legislative or process change. So moving away from what's directly measurable, but focusing on the things that are ultimately going to be more important, although sometimes there is an intersection. And looking at greater degrees of regional capacity sharing, which, as we all know, is sometimes quite problematic. The fourth is a deeper understanding of political economy development partners, and not only that understanding, but applying that in terms of development of the roadmaps and the engagement on an ongoing basis. The regional bodies can play an important part in that process. Some examples of where that's already happening is PASI, PICPA and PIFTAC, but there's more that can be done. And lastly, institutional incentives can drive proliferation of excessive complexity of PFM reform interventions. So adopting good practice principles, which are presented in the paper, and sharing the resources and knowledge is going to be important. So some final thoughts. What was very interesting through the process, and this is very much consistent with all the work over many years, is there's a very strong support from governments to officials and ministers in conducting the case studies, and overwhelmingly so. They've essentially bent over backwards to provide information and share knowledge, and a willingness and openness to improve their systems, which is quite interesting, the degree to which all countries are willing to do that, including Kiribati, where they're not performing as well when we're comparing it to Tonga. What it was even more interesting was that finding where there was a levels of defensiveness about asking questions about where things are going well and not going so well. And this introduces the whole idea of political economy of not just the partner governments, but looking at the development institutions and consultants, how they operate. And probably the greatest level of defensiveness and resistance was around those consultants who had been directly involved in the reform processes, which we found interesting. the report was very much looking backwards in terms of what has been the experience, but to the extent that that didn't reflect the future plans, there was a high degree of concern that we were misrepresenting what had been the experience in PFM reforms. So that, to us, was one of the biggest lessons, the degree of resistance, and I think that's worth thinking about, particularly from a development partner perspective. And lastly, and this links to that previous point, the need for further research and push for innovative approaches, I think there is a general, I think amongst many, there's a resistance to move beyond best practice and look at what's practical. Moving beyond what's been done in the past to what could be done in the future, and recognising that different approaches can be more effective and should be adaptable to the circumstances. And I think particularly amongst the technical expert, there's a resistance to take a broader perspective to what is possible. And ultimately, I think the solutions that are going to be most effective are not just technically driven, but linking across different sectors, thinking about development priorities and how best different approaches can get the results we're looking for, and be willing to take chances and failing as well is going to be quite important. I think there's there's generally a view that failing is bad, and you're better off actually having mediocre performance over time than you are failing. And some of that is borne out by the report. I think I'll chewed up all my time, so I'll leave with a joke for the accountants.
I assume you're all economists. We're all hipsters here. Thanks very much, Richard, for that very interesting overview of the paper, the report. Let's go straight on to our first discussant, who's Tobias, who also has a PowerPoint.
Yes.
Right? So we're going to put Tobias up on the screen with his PowerPoint.
Thanks, Stephen. We good to go?
Yep, good to go.
Great. Thanks so much, Richard. I think you did a great job kind of summarizing things. Look, because I've only got a few minutes, I'll just jump straight into it. I mean, I want to take a bit of a step back from our case studies and look at the kind of big picture of what we talk about when we talk about public financial management. Because I think it's a bit of a strange
slide.
I think there's an implicit logic that came through very clearly when we've been doing this work in the Pacific about what public financial management is as a mechanism for development. Basically, what we're saying is that if these countries change their laws and their systems and their processes and their finance ministries to match what we have, and actually a fairly small and arbitrary set of OECD countries, they're somehow going to get better outcomes. If they copy the formal institutions that we have, they will get the same outcomes. And I think that logic is problematic for several reasons that we saw very clearly in doing this work. So maybe if we can go to slide two. The first problem, I think, is that we have no evidence, really, that the standard models that we apply actually drive better outcomes. If you look at this work that Matt Andrews has done at Harvard, he basically looked at outcome-level performance of countries using government effectiveness indicators. So this is access to services, access to infrastructure, perceptions of government, so real things on the ground. He looked at that across countries, and he compared that to whether these countries had adopted some of these very common recommendations we make for public financial management. So things like having legislative oversight of the budget, having fiscal rules, having internal audit. And as you can see, there's basically zero correlation. Some highly effective governments do not have the things that we commonly recommend, and some governments that do have the things we recommend don't achieve very good outcomes. So what's the empirical basis for us recommending these very standard PFM forms and institutions? So the next slide. So the second problem, I think, is very clearly this assumption that if you change the formal institutions and the formal rules, it will actually change what happens on the ground. And I don't think that's the case, especially in the lower income and more fragile of the Pacific Island countries. If you look at some of this, this chart is fairly unintelligible, and that doesn't really matter. But you know, some of the recent work by the World Development Report that's coming out this year tried to actually measure the gap between formal rules and actual practices across all countries. And what they find is that, perhaps unsurprisingly to most of us, is that this gap exists in nearly all countries. It exists not just in low-income countries, but often in middle-income countries, upper-middle-income countries. So countries can get to a very high level of development while still having a very large gap between the formal rules and what actually happens on the ground. So, you know, why do we believe that changing formal rules will have an impact on outcomes when almost the defining characteristic of developing countries is that formal rules are ignored? Why do we put so much effort into the formal rules when realistically we shouldn't really have much expectation that they will be followed? Okay, last the next slide. And I think this is just this question of power and institutions. Things in developing countries are the way they are because it suits powerful people to have them that way. I think it's very naive of us to think that by writing a piece of paper or introducing a new process into a finance ministry, we're actually going to change ingrained behaviors that reflect the interests of powerful players. Formal institutions will only have an impact if people with power want to see those institutions enforced. And very often they have no interest in doing so. And I think this example, again, from the New World Development Report about anti-corruption commissions is very telling. You know, quite often, in general, implementation of an anti-corruption commission has zero impact on the incidence of corruption. And again, it's this point that an institutional form cannot be expected to change behavior unless it has power and incentives behind it. So let me just quickly finish on the last slide. I'm not going to read it, but I mean, I think that we need to do some serious thinking, those of us working on PFM in the Pacific or elsewhere in the world. We need to be thinking about what it is that PFM actually is. What do we mean by public financial management? What is it that a good public financial management system achieves? Because we need to get past this kind of lazy thinking that all it is implementing systems that we see in our own countries. And I think we constantly need to be thinking, both in our research and in our practice, about how the institutions that we are implementing interact with the local power structures. If we are recommending things that conflict with local power structures, we know they will not be implemented. So that should be our start point, and I think we need much more research on this. So let me stop there. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Tobias. Yes. Hope you can hear us clapping. Provocative as always, and I think we will be launching that WDR 2017 in the next few months, which looks like a pretty interesting report. So you'll be staying with us, Tobias? For the discussion? Great, excellent. All right, so I think our next speaker is Julian. And does anyone else have a PowerPoint? Are there any more PowerPoints?
There's only one.
Only one slide. So why don't I ask the other speakers just to come up the front now because we can start going into sort of discussion mode. So if Peter, yeah, Susan, Richard, you can also join at the front. And I'll just let's see. That's fine.
Yeah. Thanks, Stephen. G'day, everyone. Look, firstly, I'd just like to say thanks for the opportunity to comment. I think it's a really important report. It certainly brings together, I think, a lot of issues which have been bubbling behind the surface, so it's really welcome to see. And I'd like to start by saying I broadly accept with everything in the report, really. I think it hits all the marks. My background is not PFM. I'm not even an economist. I've worked largely on issues of general institutional reform, largely in Melanesia. So I thought I'd sort of reflect on some of the issues that I've experienced around institutional reform, particularly in Solomon Islands, but to a lesser extent in PNG. And I think that might be an interesting angle anyway because of the absence of a Melanesian case study in the report. I thought I'd make three quick points, two about the politics and the whole angle of what's political ownership and engagement, and then a final one on capacity. The first point I'd like to make is the issue of ownership. In my experience, the way ownership has been dealt with, particularly in the Pacific, is that development partners have worked with partner governments to agree on reform plans, national development strategies and the like. And then the implementation challenge is about implementing those plans. In practice, I think there's a lot of problems with relying on these plans and strategies as a proxy for ownership. The way, particularly in Melanesia, that politics works is there's a fairly large disconnect between the executive, the political competition, and the bureaucracy. And so a lot of the plans become quite artificial quite quickly. And so the link between, as I understand it, PFM and development strategies and the like is quite challenging as a reliance on, as a measure of ownership and a guide to what to implement. Of course, that raises a whole lot of challenges about how do you build ownership, how do you support ownership, where do you find ownership? And I think they're really important questions. The second issue, I think, is a broader one about political economy. And again, I think the political economy points are really importantly made. And the report alludes to a lot. And one of the things I'd like to raise, though, is really, and it's maybe around the future research agenda, is the way in which political economy is actually driving reconstructions of state systems and processes and impacting on PFM systems, but much broadly, much more broadly about the role of the state. And in many respects, I think some of the PFM challenges are sparking political elites, bureaucratic elites to search for new forms of service delivery and engagement. In Melanesia, that's particularly apparent in the rise of CDFs, constituency development funds, and the sort of push to decentralisation, which is having profound impacts on not only PFM systems, but service delivery systems, and certainly the relationship between the two. The personalisation of development models, the role of MPs, these are all formal systems. They're not corruption, but they certainly take us well with outside the realms of sort of orthodox and standard sort of OECD notions of PFM. And I think how we engage with those is really fundamental. Certainly understanding them is really fundamental and important. I think it's very confounding for development partners in what you do in those spaces. And I think that's an immediate priority in terms of trying to join sort of PFM systems and broader processes of sort of state building, capacity building, service delivery. And then the final one is on this notion of capacity building, and it follows from the previous two points. Again, I think one of the risks with PFM is even though we say we need a sort of responsive and problem-driven approach, in my experience, the system is, or the way that plays out is that you still start with a sort of agreed plan, and then it's about sequencing and prioritisation and all of that sort of stuff. It's not about a plan that responds to the problem of service delivery. So when you sort of take that approach, I think there's a real challenge about then what capacity constraints are you talking about? Is it capacity constraints to implement the plan in a more sensible and sort of low-key way? Or is it a much broader issue of capacity constraint, the ability of PFM systems at a local level to talk with local service providers, which opens up a whole range of public sector reform issues? What's the notion of the state in a highly decentralised and very low capacity environment? And so I think the final thing I'd like to encourage is a very broad notion of capacity about what's a pragmatic form of PFM that will suit the realities of the emerging sort of state structures in the region. So I'll stop there. Oh, actually, one final point, I suppose, and an open question. And from someone that doesn't really sort of have his head around PEFA processes and all of that sort of stuff, I'd be interested in the degree to which PEFA tools and the sort of suite of tools we've got for PFM are fit for purpose in terms of engaging with these questions. Do PEFA approaches, for example, and again, this is an open question from my inexperience, but do they allow us to ask the right questions we need to about engaging with increasingly decentralised and localised forms of state structure?
Right, thanks, Julian. I think it also strikes me these there are much broader links involved in all this. Peter, don't sit down. I think you're next on the list.
Okay. Can you hear me with us? That seems all right, doesn't it? I did have one slide to go up. Can we do that? And I think my comments here will be in the spirit of things. It's been good to hear the presentations and also Julian's comments, so perhaps not anything brand new. I'm also not an expert at PFM, but it's increasingly imposing on my work. I'm a health economist, so I do a lot of work in the health sector, worked in the Pacific, but more broadly across Asia. And the whole issue of PFM is becoming a stronger part of our health financing, health planning work. So it's a very pertinent issue. And I must say, I congratulate Tobias, Richard and others on the report, the case studies and the findings and principles that are coming out from them. I think the approach and the language is starting to sound very good and be very, very appropriate. Yesterday, when I was trying to think of something to say, I did quickly look at some IMF data on the size of government as a part of the broader economy across Asian and Pacific countries. And it wasn't too surprising to see that the Pacific countries come out at the top of the list in terms of the size of government within the economy. This is percentage of GDP, total government expenditure is percentage of GDP. Can't vouch for the figures, they come off the website and from the IMF. But it's nothing surprising here, I think, and it's perhaps a pattern that we might expect that small island countries like Kiribati and Tuvalu, the government is pretty much the whole of the economy. And then we go down the list, Papua New Guinea, low down the list because it's got a big mining sector, Vanuatu has finance, Fiji has a diversified economy. And I've just put Australia in there as a sort of benchmark to see how things run. But in some ways, to me, this is what frames the problem of public financial management. It is a very important issue in the Pacific, and there's very good reason to understand why that's the case. What's done with government money and how it works has a big impact on the economy. So a couple of points to make. My first one would be to say my increasing impression of PFM, especially in the Pacific region, but also across Asia, is that there are essentially two aspects. This is sort of conceptual. There is a very strong accounting function within PFM because we need to know what the budget is, where it goes, whether it gets there or not, what happens when it does. The other side of it, I think, is the economic function of PFM. And because of these sorts of numbers, PFM and the management of public finances becomes a very big macroeconomic issue. So it's central to macroeconomic national level planning. Now, these countries don't have much control over exchange rates. They don't have much control over trade. They don't have much control over currency. They're subject to international influences like interest rates and other things. It's what happens with the government budget that often determines the macroeconomic setting. So I'm impressed by this, and the reason for saying this is PFM becomes a big question in national economic policy. So it's situated, I think, somewhere in there. We have to both get the numbers right and the planning process right, and the bigger reason is it's going to affect what happens in the economy. Another thought is the role of the planning function in all of this. Clearly there's a regulation function when we talk about PFM because we're setting budgets and we want them carried out. And we want to know where the money goes and on all aspects associated with that. Regulation and accounting might come together. Planning, regulation, accounting systems sort of come together. I think the other side of it has to come under the heading of incentives. And I do not mean purely monetary financial incentives. I mean the broader incentives about carrying out the plan. And my impression in reading the case studies anyway, these two, and then a bit of other information as well, is that the officials down there who are responsible for doing this have to have some incentive to do it. If life goes, you know, you have a plan, you have PFM, life, you get capacity building, but life goes on. No need to bother with anything. You went to the workshop and that's fine. Now, incentive can be very broadly based, and you know, I'd be thinking of sort of professional incentives. I don't know how to frame this, like reputation or performance or something, not performance-based funding, but some idea that it means something to actually carry out a function, and there's some reason for doing it, and there's some benefit from it. We talked over lunch a little bit about some of the global fund processes where it's important that we actually carry out the work that's in the plan, and then, you know, you get your next round of funding and so on. So there needs to be some sort of consequence if things don't work out. So I think that's another set of thoughts, the regulation business against the incentive business. And I think the last one that would be on my mind is the role of the donors in all of this. Clearly, the government sectors are very big in these countries, but places like Micronesia and others as well, this is government sector, but a lot of that money comes from the donors, doesn't it? So it's what the donors are doing within that framework that counts a lot and has a very, very big impact. And I want to say that the comments both by Richard and Julian, I think I would endorse there that when it comes to donors, technical assistance, what consultants say, that is really critical. I can be a little bit critical too, because I often work with a technical advisor or a consultant or something like that. So I've been conscious of this too. But, you know, bringing in the blueprint is useless. The whole thing must begin when we go into country by just listening and talking and understanding what's there, what's needed, what the starting point is. And I would say the formula is, you know, build on what exists. Don't simply try to change the whole system. And I think that's really where the report is heading. So that would be my few comments. Thank you.
Great. Words of wisdom, I think. So our last discussant is Susan Ivetts.
Yeah, great. Thanks. I work in health. I'm a health specialist with the World Bank based in the Sydney office. And we've had an opportunity over the past few years with funding support from Australia, from DFAT, and more recently from New Zealand as well, in a number of countries in the Pacific to really focus on health sector, public financial management and health financing more broadly. So that work's been very much around looking at basic annual budget cycle processes, so very much around compliance and really trying to get those linkages with efficiency and quality of expenditure, looking at what's actually being achieved for the resources that are being used. So these comments really are just reflecting a little bit on some of those experiences in some of those countries past few years. But I thought it was important just to reflect on, you know, we often talk about, and certainly our country colleagues, governments, both in central agencies but also ministries of health, do often talk about that need to really improve the quality of expenditure. And particularly in the health sector, typically in the Pacific at least, the health sector normally gets a relatively good share of the overall government budget from the domestic allocation, excluding donor funds, but then also gets often quite a good allocation of support from development partners as well. So we often find around 10% or more of the government's own domestic budget goes to health in quite a few of the countries. And then from development partner funding, about a quarter of the budget, sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less, comes from external sources. So, you know, they're both really important aspects to thinking about quality of expenditure. With changing times, you know, modest economic growth in a number of the countries and reducing traditional donor financing, there is a real pressure increasingly to be looking at efficiency and quality of expenditure, because it's going to be hard to increase that fiscal space for health without really trying to think through some of those issues. So that has been a space that we've increasingly got into. But we do find in our experience, like, we have this discussion, and I think the governments themselves often talk about this, but, you know, the main institutions support it as well. You know, we talk about how to improve the quality of expenditure, and yet, you know, when we look at these issues, like at the big spending service delivery agencies in the Pacific, health and education often get some of the largest allocations of budget funds. When we go and then look at how they get the support to actually deliver and manage those funds, for example, in one of the countries where we work, there's been a finance controller. There's not been a finance controller in a permanent position for over 3 years now. You know, these are major, serious positions that don't get funded. So it's kind of ludicrous saying, at one hand, we want to have quality of expenditure, but then these countries don't get the support, these big spending agencies You know, we don't have adequate resourcing in the finance units. They're very modest little finance units, often very modest little human resource management units. Procurement is virtually non-existent often. There's no training for procurement officers. Like malaria people get trained to the cows come home, maternal and child health, you know, all important areas to be supporting and focusing on. But these are the core service areas that are about really helping that fund flow in a timely, appropriate way, just don't get the support and assistance, which also I think makes you wonder at times, you know, in Solomon Islands, just as an example, there's often a situation where the development budget, which is mainly for capital expenditure, is always grossly underspent. So year in, year out, health always gets a reasonable allocation of that, but it's always, you know, tight, you know, less than 10% spent each year. But this has been the case for years now. And, you know, even though there's huge need for upgrading of facilities and support in a whole range of areas, there's no real assistance to try and address and work through these real bottlenecks to making these funds flow. And, you know, I sort of wonder sometimes, is it just another way of government maintaining their sort of fiscal balances in different ways? Because there's really no, and they can say, oh, we've given the ministries money, but they never spend it. But then they've done nothing to really help move that in any substantive, practical way. So, you know, I just think these are part of the reality checks and the discussions we also need to be having. Maybe just one thing on this quality of expenditure, again, just in Solomon Islands, but as we've been trying to think through how are these different agencies resourced and supported to really deliver on, you know, quite complex ministries and with staff spread across the country. In the finance unit, in the Ministry of Health, the proportion of staff out of the proportion of all their established staff in the Ministry of Health is 0.5% that work in the finance unit, but the average for the other ministries is just under 5%. So, you know, you can see that the difference is quite significant, and yet a lot of these other ministries don't have lots of staff spread across the provinces, across the many islands. They just don't have that level of complexity. And similarly, you know, in the career structures for finance controllers or other senior corporate service areas, you know, there's no career structure or progression. So what is the incentive for me to work as a finance controller in a really messy, complex ministry like health when I can get the same pay for working in a much smaller ministry with no staff in the provinces? You know, I get the same pay, I get the same conditions. You know, there's no structure of, you know, you work up to being more senior and qualified working in these more complex, demanding ministries, but you're also remunerated accordingly. So those career structures or progressions aren't there in most of the countries that we work in, at least. So I think that's an area that we really need to look at more. And I know people tend to shy away from civil service sort of reform programs and stuff because they're messy, they're hard, and nobody's really done a very good job at that, including World Bank. But, you know, I think these are the real realities if we're trying to talk about substance and think these things through with governments more. And then I guess just the one other point I wanted to make was really on the mixed messages that I think we often have in terms of what we say we're committed to and what we're trying to support. And I think this is true for many institutions. You know, there's a lot of talk around really trying to support countries to build their own systems and processes, but then I think the actual practice on the ground doesn't support that at all. We've still got very fragmented funding sources in many respects. It's very confusing for many ministries trying to do their core roles and functions, and then they're sort of swamped with many other competing demands and priorities from development partners. And health does attract a lot of development partners, and, you know, in some of the countries we work in, there's 16 or so different main development partners working with different demands and expectations on what they're doing. But I just thought this little example was hopefully just a useful way to demonstrate it. This is real world, happened this year from one of the small Pacific countries. But You know, this is just looking at the 6-monthly report that would help them do, just trying to track, you know, what their allocation and expenditure is, and then starting to look at what's actually being delivered in terms of service outputs and ultimately health outcomes. But just there, you know, you can see, you know, we understand that there's lots of issues about development partners coming on system and putting their resources through the government's own system. And obviously a lot of the rhetoric around why we're trying to support public financial management is to help give partners confidence to put their money through the system. And until that's stronger and people have that level of confidence, they're not willing to do that. But nonetheless, getting coherence around what resources are available. If we're serious about governments being able to really understand what's the full resource envelope they have, not just money, but people and TA and other supplies and assistance, and then thinking about how to use that in the most efficient and effective way to get the quality outcomes that are needed. In this one country that we've been working in, you know, you can see there's, if you take out salaries and allowances, there's still quite a considerable proportion of funding that's coming through. It's on budget in that the government knows those monies are committed to the health sector in different respects. But there's no reporting. Nobody knows how much of those resources have been used. And this was, we were discussing this in August this year in this country. But, you know, the government had no idea how these resources been used, if they were for non-communicable diseases, had they been used or spent, or maternal and child health or whatever. So, you know, until we can clean up our acts, like as development partners on some of these things, you know, it's very hard for countries to bring this together. And it does matter, because a lot of development partner funds aren't for salaries or allowances, they are for those operational expenditure areas, which can mean a lot for what activities actually happen and what services are actually provided. So having better coherence around these things matters. But, you know, it is about, you know, matching up the language, I guess, with what the commitments and agreements have been to try and improve this use of government systems and processes, and just having that transparency about resource allocation and use. I might leave it there.
All right, thanks to all our speakers. We have gone slightly over time, but we've still got 25 minutes for Q&A. So I invite you to make some contributions from the floor. James.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Thanks to all the speakers. I was doing some work in Solomons recently, and there's one of the new things in the environment there is the spread of a government IT platform. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for this in government, and a lot of hopes held out that maybe this holds up the prospect of improvements in the government payment system and better transparency and efficiency, etc., etc. I wonder if this came out at all in the case studies in Kiribati and Tonga. I mean, are there efficiencies and gains to be won through IT?
So you might take a few questions since we've got a panel, and then you can choose which ones you want to answer. So.
Well, mine's a little bit similar, because I was just wondering how this was actually implemented in country. So were consultants sent over there for a week or two to sort of, you know, I should have read the report there. Right. But is there an idea that there's a specialist team in one of the central ministries, or are you looking to implement it into things like health and education separately? So I'm just wondering how it's expected to perpetuate and be sustained in the long term. Okay. Did you want to just introduce yourself? Sorry. Oh, sorry.
I'm
Jenny Price. I've worked with actually National Health Accounts in Fiji, and up in Fiji and Timor Leste in health equity financing, so I'm more in the health stream. So I'm interested in looking at the how efficiently the data can be collected and reported.
Thank you. Okay.
And sustaining people who can do that, because that's a real problem.
Beth, were you going to?
No.
You didn't have your hand up? Okay. Any more questions before we go back to the panel in this round? Yeah, Nima.
It's nice to see Richard. So in Afghanistan, you are a star advisor. the finance ministry. My question is in terms of, in regard to the political economy, colleagues mentioned about, because what's happening during the first stage of the reform, there is resistance. And mostly what's happening, the actors, for example, in the case of Afghanistan, uses external accountability or donors as a force to advance the reforms or implementation of the reforms. When we are talking about the political economy, what exactly do we mean in the context of Pacific? Because we are not talking about post-conflict context. And second, in terms of innovation, also like information management technology was indicated. So where does it fit? Because we have just the normal reforms and also innovation. And where does it fit in terms of just the broad framework?
Okay, so I invite the panel to respond, including Tobias. I don't know if you could hear all those questions, Tobias, but...
to be honest, I couldn't hear everything, so why doesn't Richard kick off?
Happy to. I guess the first question around the IT systems and opportunities. So I'm aware of the IT system and its developments in Solomon Islands. It's probably one of the best examples of where there has been a development, a broader development of IT systems in the platform, not just the Ministry of Finance, but trying to incorporate other elements at a national level, down at the provincial level. We don't see the same thing happening in countries such as Kiribati and Tonga. In Kiribati, it's a very much a fragmented system. There's still a lot of spreadsheets used. And the attaché FMIS that they've got in place, we're looking at, there's a World Bank team out there at the moment looking at options to replace it because it's not fit for purpose. So I think that's an example where you have the wrong system as an impediment to doing things well. In the case of Tonga, the system's broadly capable but hasn't been updated for about 6 or 7 years. So it was actually a good system that's now become, again, an impediment to effective PFM management because it doesn't match the requirements of the current day. So I think that, I guess, partly answered the question. The second bit of the question, how can it be part of doing something more? I think the key thing is not being an impediment, but the bigger challenge is how can it actually promote something bigger than beyond just PFM? And I think there's a bunch of risks around that, particularly if you're not managing that system very well. I know in Tonga and Kiribati, there's problems around backup. And those types of things in Solomon Islands, the reason why it was outsourced and took a whole different approach is because it wasn't integrated and there was a lack of broad capacity to manage that system. So I think my view would be that you need to have a system to match the requirements, what are the PFM needs, that matches the capacity and is at a reasonable cost. Is it going to lead to transformational change in the way the government operates? Possibly, but I would imagine it's largely going to mirror and support the broader approaches that are being adopted, and I'm differentiating that between what are the broader transformational opportunities through the implementation of fibre optic connections across the Pacific. So I see it as facilitating better public financial management in a safer, more cohesive way rather than more overarching change, but the opposite does apply equally. So does that answer the question? Yeah. And the other question I can answer is around how did the consultations take place? So essentially it was over, in both countries, a two-week period. So the team in each case went in and had discussions, not just with the Ministry of Finance, but a whole range of stakeholders across line ministries, and developed some preliminary findings from that. That was built on by having consultants or part of the team and been involved in these countries for many, many years. So it's drawing on the experience probably 5 or 6 years beforehand.
and having a lot of engagement with a whole range of people to validate the information I think received by the interviews that were taking place. So we were getting information from the government officials and consultants, but then we validated and cross-checked it against other information available. So that's essentially how the process worked.
Yes, Susan.
Just more on that first question, just maybe sort of reinforcing what Rich was saying, but just from a health sector perspective, we've just been doing a little bit of work like cross-country comparison in some of the countries that we're working on workload, like in the finance units in the ministries of health, and comparing Solomon's Vanuatu and Kiribati, just because we know those environments quite well. And Kiribati has a much higher level of work, even for a similar level of staff. And I think a lot of that relates to it's a much more hands-on, non-automated processing because of these problems with their FMIS system, their attaché, and then they've got to try and reconcile it with the access database because that doesn't cover all these things that attaché should and stuff. So it's really slowed things down in terms of their transaction processing and handling. So it's quite interesting, I think, just trying to understand, like for us, it's been interesting trying to understand those differences in workload, just the quantitative stuff, but then also starting to look at the qualitative, you know, how many, you know, submissions get refused or get pushed back from ministries of finance and things like that. And then the other thing, I think, just with the broader IT access, though, I know from a health ministry perspective, saying Solomon Islands, for a long while we didn't even have read access to the AX system. And I think it's really improved as some of those things became available. Mm-hmm. And I know Vanuatu with SmartStream and stuff, that's really helped as well. And again, in Kiribati, it's been much harder because of the problems with the platforms that are in place. And I think, you know, on one hand, we sort of beat up the line agencies for poor expenditure and things like that. But then if they don't have the capacity to monitor and look at that information in a real-time way, it really has an impact. And then there's all the implications for even more timely health information on service outputs and things like that across different sectors. I think that could be really valuable as you try to bring together the, you know, what's been achieved through the resources that are being used, just trying to get a better sense of performance overall. So I think it does matter, but obviously it's got to be appropriate for the context.
I'd just like to respond to the political economy question. And I mean, I think the first thing to note is there are examples, important examples of perhaps conflict engagement. So Ramsey, for example, in Solomon Islands, Bougainville. And in fact, I think some of the post-conflict issues have conditioned and shaped certainly the historical efforts to strengthen PFM systems. So if you look at Ramsey, you had quite a large-scale intervention over a very long term. And I think it's fair to say, and I worked on Ramsey for a period, that one consequence of that was quite donor-driven systems reforms, including PFM. So a lot of TA and a lot of resources invested in trying to centralise, particularly central ministries in the state. And I think one of the challenges that Ramsey faced is that it was very difficult for it to engage beyond central ministries, and certainly that was apparent in lines in PFM systems, but also in the public sector reform more broadly. And I think it also tended to support quite ambitious technical solutions around IT systems, payroll systems and all of that sort of stuff. So I think the significance of this report is that it's drawing on some of those lessons and recommending a more sober sort of approach to some of these things.
Stephen, perhaps just to take up some of the sector specific aspects of PFM being new to the business, I'm not sure exactly what's been done so far, but that's probably one area where further research would be useful to see how things do differ between sectors. And I'm thinking specifically about the health sector now and some of the experience we've had, more especially in Asia than in the Pacific. One of the elements of public financial administration in the health sector, and especially in Asian countries now, is an increasing and greater emphasis on the service delivery aspects of the public sector activities. And just by way of illustration, in the health sector, the traditional budgeting method is the top-down planning apparatus from the central ministry down through the provinces, districts, and so on. And increasingly, we're seeing that the budget business is a trickle-down method where, at every stage there's a sense of leakage, and by the time we get to the health centre and the hospital, there's not much left. And so there's not much to manage in any case. And there's something there at the heart of public financial management. So there are two sides to this, I think. One is cleaning up the trickle so that more of it gets down. But that's not the only question, because inevitably, if you have different layers in the system, you're going to get leakage. Mm. So doing away with the layers is going to be a much more direct route. And in many places, I know Cambodia rather well, the attempt is to bypass this this tiered system with direct payments to facilities. And then that requires a certain apparatus of its own, which means perhaps something related to internal contracting or subcontract methods, and something related to performance-based financing and management of one sort or another. Not that it's a panacea, I would not think that. And so public financial management then broadens out a little bit into not just the accounting role and making sure everything's in place, but also some of these alternate methods of public financial administration. Now, I don't say what we're going to do next, but there are some areas in there that I think could be useful in terms of further research. And it makes me think, too, knowing what's happening in the Pacific is very important, but a comparison with some of the, I think, lower-income Asian countries, and let's say China, Malaysia, Singapore, but some of the lower-income Asian countries, I think might be worthwhile as well to see how those things balance up.
All right, let's go back to the audience. We'll keep you, Tobias, to sum up at the end, or to interject in the next round. Yeah, please.
Becky Dodd, I'm a Pacific Health Advisor in DFAT. I just wanted to pick up on Peter's point and just sort of pose the question about the extent to which some of these challenges are a function of an absolute lack of resources, because if you haven't got a budget to manage, then there's more of a point of developing budget management skills, right? And I know that in particularly in some of the Pacific, the Melanesian countries, donors might be 25% of the sector, but they're a much bigger proportion of the activity budget, up to 80%. And we have very strong oversight over that money. So the amount of budget management which actually falls to officials in the sector is really quite limited. It's a bit of a simplistic view perhaps, but is there a kind of relationship between kind of scarcity and that capacity?
Okay, we've got quite a few questions now. Yeah, Matt and Ron?
Yeah, the point you made about the donors reporting, one of the PIFA scores, if I recall correctly, relates to donors and their reporting. First question, what was the score for donors in those two countries? And what do donors need to do to sort themselves out in terms of setting a better standard for themselves in terms of reporting expenditures and providing other information related to how they're spending resources?
Yeah, Ron?
Rhonda and Crawford. A couple of comments. This is essentially all about the supply side. There's no discussion really of the demand side. Putting in accountability measures so that people who are on the receiving end of these services can put in pressure to see better performance. And I would point to a difficulty in the Pacific with the lack of secure rights to land. So that for people's health and education, they've got a, they can see that these things should be helping them, and therefore, you can get them to take an interest in whether those services are being delivered well or not. So the classic examples are publicising what the expenditure on health should be, what expenditure for schools and school districts and whatever, and put it up on the notice board so that people know what they're supposed to be getting. But for other services such as infrastructure, you know, if people don't own land, there's no asset to which those services can add value. So they have no interest in seeing that those kinds of services that would add value to our, in our circumstances, where we own land and we, you know, have an interest in the road going past our place, working well and all that. You know, there's no real interest in seeing that those services are delivered. And so, you know, there is a problem with that. The other comment is, when I was at the University of South Pacific, I hosted a Belgian economics professor who was brought in by the IMF to develop essentially, you know, the simplest PFM system that they could think of, essentially, you know, built on the KISS principle. And he did that. I don't know if you ever found that, Bob, but that, you know, seems to have been lost in, you know, since then. But, you know, he and his assistants set out to, you know, to actually build and then teach, you know, what would be the sort of simplest kind of finance management system for the developing countries. But I think, you know, that principle still applies. It should be, you should be implementing the simplest system you can implement. What I saw over there was, you know, Cook Islands were trying to introduce accrual accounting. I mean, the next time I saw the person who was doing that, she was working in the finance department for Australia. Even here, we don't have enough accountants to implement properly accrual accounting. And so, you know, it's still trying to recover from that in the Pacific.
Okay, just very briefly.
I just want to pick up on that. So my name is Maude, I work with the World Bank. I spent 3 years working on public financial management with the Minister of Health in Solomon Islands. And in terms of just streamlining and simplifying, one of the biggest successes we've had working with the Minister of Health in Solomon Islands on PFM was implementing something that was already in place, IMPRESS management. So we didn't change how it was done, the Ministry of Finance didn't change, they just started implementing something that was already in the rules and regulation. And so we keep talking a lot about reform, but it's also just picking up something, I don't know if it was Tobias or Richard that said, there's already rules and regulations in place. Some of them are actually quite good, and it's about finding the ones that have a big impact, that there's political appetite to implement, and having, I hate that word, but quick wins, because they're neither quick nor big wins always, but picking up on those instead of trying to start from scratch and completely changing what's already sometimes a relatively good system or rules that are in place.
Thank you. Look, I'm also going to abuse my position and ask a question. This might be the last chance. Also, there'll be at least one question Tobias can hear. It's a very interesting, important report, but it's a little frustrating, right? It reads like a critique, like it could be written by the Office of Development Effectiveness or by an academic or sort of appear on a debt policy blog. But, I mean, you people are running this public financial management support to these countries, right? If you've got DFAT, you've got the World Bank, you've got New Zealand Aid. I mean, you're responsible for it. So is the problem the ADB? Right? Is the problem PIFTEC and the IMF? Are they not on board, right? Or are we, I mean, we are the donors, you know, just really paying lip service to these ideas that people like Tobias and others have been advocating, you know, as the donor position for some time? Are they not really, have the donors really not bought into those critiques? And, you know, that's my suspicion. And I just, you know, so a specific sort of question or angle to that is on this issue of capacity, you know, enhancement and substitution, right? Are donors now funding people, you know, actually to work in these? Is there a shift towards, away from capacity building, towards inline positions in the Pacific?
That's a great question, Steve. Look, I've thought a lot about this. I don't think we're saying it's the ADB and the IMF. I think we all do this in different ways. I think the reason we do this is because So what I mean is, the reason why this kind of, I suppose this kind of critique has not been kind of more widely recognized and reflected in practice is that it remains easy to do a standard product. I think any institution has this problem. It's easy to do something that is recognizable. It's easy to do something that's been done somewhere else before. It's easy to do something that your manager and your manager's manager will recognize as something that we do. So if you're saying we're going to come in and we're going to do a PIFA assessment, or we're going to do an MTIF, or we're going to do a VAT, people immediately know what that means, and they immediately have some comfort that it's the kind of thing that we do. Whereas I think if you're wanting to say we're going to come in and we're going to look at this system that's, you know, not really a very great cutting-edge system, but we think it might work in this context, so we're going to put a lot of effort into strengthening this existing system, the burden of proof on the project manager, I think, it is much greater, because you have to understand the context. You have to understand what's happening to make the case that this needs to happen. Whereas some of these kind of standard products, they travel internationally, they're packaged, everyone knows what they mean, everyone knows what they are, so they're easy to be sold. So I guess what I'm saying is, I think it's a much kind of deeper problem about the incentives on donors in general, which is to do things, to be honest, as quickly and easily as possible. And I think it's that emphasis on getting an output, getting a product delivered, rather than focusing so much on the outcomes, especially when the outcomes can often be very difficult to measure. So I think it's going to continue to be a struggle. And I think that's why there was such an emphasis in this report on mutual accountability. You know, I don't think it's realistic to say that each of our institutions are suddenly going to change our ways overnight because of this report that we've written. That's not going to happen. But I think if we start to do these things like sharing terms of reference between ourselves, signing up to some kind of mission statement about taking a more problem-driven approach, then we can start to subtly change those incentives, which I think is what needs to happen.
All right, thanks, Tobias. And we'll just go to the panel for closing comments and to address the various remarks.
Add to what Tobias said, two additional factors I think are, first of all, what you measure is what becomes important. Quite
so
easy.
Just hold on. Sorry, Tobias, can you just go on mute? I think we're getting some feedback.
What you measure is what's important quite often, and it's quite easy to measure putting in place new PFM legislation, working on a budget documentation. They're all very tangible. Improving compliance is very difficult to measure, even though it could be more important. So people tend to steer towards the more tangible, and you see this when talking about Ramsey, a lot of it was about tangible, high-level interventions in the Ministry of Finance. Again, building on what Tobias said, you need an in-depth understanding to do more than that and be willing to commit to this over a longer term with not getting the immediate results. Secondly, in recognition that these are not homogenous organisations, so whilst there might be high-level understanding at an overall level of the World Bank and DFAT and so forth, alluded to earlier on, you've got a lot of consultants doing work, and they don't necessarily represent the views of those organisations in terms of what they do. They bring their own skills and experience. And actually, that has been the experience of DFAT. A lot of people coming in, you bring skills and resources from the consultant, but you also bring different viewpoints which may not necessarily represent what we're trying to achieve.
But you are paying for this.
Twice, yes.
Yeah, anyone?
I'm just responding to Ron's point on the demand side. I think that's a really interesting question. I think one of the interesting things in the big challenges in the Pacific is the way citizens are engaging and understanding the state itself is changing. So if you look at constituency funding models, in many respects that's emerged out of frustration about the inability of the state to deliver goods and services. And Terence Wood's work from DevPol, and certainly James Batley and my colleague Colin Wiltshire from SSGM are doing interesting work about how CDS work, And that's really shows the local level demand for sort of the MP to become a provider of public goods. And so in terms of a demand for a sort of robust public financial management system that we would recognise, it's simply not there in terms of how people understand the state and the expectations they have from it. So how you engage with that can be really hard, because pretty mainstream sort of civil society engagement programs and the like aren't in that space to start with.
There's a couple of questions about the donor. Are you going to address that? About the donor funding?
Oh, for the PFAS scores and stuff. Yeah, I find this interesting though, because I think when PFAS are done, certainly in my experience, they never really look at line agency stuff. It's all very central agency, big picture. And there's very little discussion. And similarly, I also find it interesting, like with the IMF Article 4 missions and things like that as well, because we often see them afterwards and it's sort of, you know, there's no issue with arrears or whatever, and like we think at the sector level there's major issues, you know, and it's just kind of interesting the disconnect behind between all these sort of discussions and reflections on things. I'm not so sure on the, like, what the PFA scores show for donor aspects. I mean, we've argued a lot, including with Tobias about
Susan, just to jump in on that, there's D's and C's. I mean, almost all the Pacific Island countries, very bad scores on that.
Yeah. But, you know, it is that thing. I mean, we've often talked about, should we look at some of those aspects at the health sector level? And I know, like, talking to the PIPA Secretariat in Washington and stuff in the past, they'd said they wanted to start doing more sort of subsets or, like, sector-focused PIPAs, but, you know, we've sort of not really embraced that per se, but it is interesting.
Just to note, the new PIPA framework doesn't look at donor effectiveness any longer.
Oh, so they solved that. So much of an initial capital. Just one other thing which links into the efficiency and side of the discussions, the quality of expenditure, but it made me think after your comment, Mark, just about when land ownership and those things. Even, like, you know, we're found in the health sector, just knowledge about your own, like the cost centres and the ownership about what you're responsible for, even just from that sort of professional perspective, has been interesting. Because, you know, you look at like Solomon Islands where electricity costs are really high, and, you know, there is a lot of expenditure, like at the National Hospital and stuff on electricity. But, you know, when you talk to them, you're like, about all the lights that are on outside during the day and stuff, but nobody thinks to turn them off because they never see the bill, they never see what they're paying for. So, you know, when you point this out, it's like, oh yeah, that's interesting, for, you know, their use of certain, you know, supplies and commodities that are ridiculously high cost, and they're using them for crazy things when they should be using a piece of tissue instead of a piece of a gauze, you know, dressing gauze or something. But they're never seeing those costs. They've got no idea. It's only when you start showing them, like, did you know you're spending this much money on that? Like, oh, wow, you know. So, and there is an interest in trying to contain it, but it's the first time anyone's shown it to them, or at least in a long time. So it is, you know, like how we help people understand that, how we structure these things a bit better, I think, for more practical, real responses.
Okay. Peter, anything?
Not very much. I'm just reminded of an expression that I think perhaps originally came from B.A. Lennon, I may be wrong, who said that the educators must first be educated. And I think that's very apt, as a matter of fact. I think this report is a very good critique that strikes all the right notes, and that's a very big step forward in itself. The next step is to make sure that our side of the equation, the technical advisors, the donors and others, learn from that critique and do it the hard way. So as Tobias says, there's an easy way to do it and there's a hard way to do it. Well, the hard way is actually understanding the context and the situation and educating ourselves in that, and then we can be in a position to do much more of this. So I'm encouraged by this report for that reason.
Great. Well, on that note, I'll bring proceedings to a close. Sorry we're a little bit over time, but I think it's a very interesting discussion. Thanks, everyone, again, for coming. And please join with me in thanking our speakers and discussants.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.